This is the Blaze Radio On Demand.
There's a threat on the horizon so deadly that experts warn it could wipe out 9 in 10 Americans. The Pentagon, a former director of the CIA, and the American Society of Civil Engineers are all sounding the alarm. But nobody in the mainstream media is listening. This event has the potential to cause economic collapse, mass pandemics, and the complete and total breakdown of the food supply all at once. I'm talking about our nation's vulnerable and crumbling power grid. Fox News warns our death toll would be staggering if the grid goes down. I want to tell you about a free video that has everything you need to know about this threat and how to protect yourself. Watch it now at blackoutvideo.com. Go to blackoutvideo.com and watch this controversial video right now. If you want to survive power failures and blackouts, you need to see this video. Go to blackoutvideo.com now.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is
The Buck Sexton Show.
Team Buck, I'm excited because it's Friday and we get to hang out for a bit now. So thank you very much for lending me your ears. So much to talk about today. This is going to be a bit of a wild ride because there's at least two, maybe three shows worth of stuff going on just today. And I'll have to sort of leave some stuff on the cutting room floor as I go. But part of my idea here, and by the way, broad voice lines are open right from the get-go, 888-900-3393. You want to call in, light up those lines. Who knows? Maybe we'll even get a little note from LJ down in Dallas and say that we can give out a couple t-shirts. I don't know if we have enough time. We'll see. Could happen. Part of what happens here when I have so much to talk about is that I think I try to put it under an umbrella of some kind, sort of create a general framework into which we can put our ideas. And if I had to come up with a framework, or we could even call it sort of a title, an overview of today's show, which is going to be focused on things that are just happening now, but if we're going to take a broad stroke, we're going to take the biggest paintbrush we have and paint the whole side of the house, not a little bit here and there, the entire side of the house. If I got the big brush out. Lies and lawlessness. That's sort of hashtag lies and lawlessness. That's what we're going to be talking about today. Because I think those are now the defining characteristics of this administration. If you're going to talk about the shortcomings of and again, this White House, this president and senior staff and advisors, there's a lot of places we could go on this. There's all sorts of talk we could have on what they've done wrong. We could discuss the unbelievable. I mean, at this point, by the way, from a messaging perspective alone, never mind the actual policy and underlying morality of all this. From a messaging perspective, it is amateur hour. We know that. There is an amateurishness that also is compounded with a just breathtaking arrogance. And by the way, we often put this just on Obama, and certainly it's top down, but this is true of many of his senior advisors as well. This is a culture in this White House. This is true. This was true of the Axelrods and the Jarretts and the Holders and go down the list. But lies and lawlessness is what we're going to be talking about today. And when we see each of the major issues I'm going to be breaking down for you, either lies or lawlessness or both applies. They can both be put in those, or rather anything can be put in both of those categories. So I wanted to just start for a second with some thoughts on the dresses black and blue, my friends. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go on Twitter. So let's just discard that one. Let's just get that one out of the way. The dress is black and blue, but now let's transition into something more serious and substantive. Also, Llama Fest 2015, way more exciting than the dress throwdown on Twitter that occurred last night. The llamas running around. Free the llamas. Big hitter, the llamas. You know what I'm talking about. But because we all had this moment, those of us who spend way too much time on social media got to see this whole debate unfold, I think it also brought us closer into thinking about what it will mean when this sort of freewheeling, let's just see what happens on the internet situation no longer exists. When all of a sudden the government has so much control over the exchange of ideas that occurs in the digital realm, that these sorts of things will be at least influenced by government policy, right? That what you can say, that the politics of the web all of a sudden become open to the intrusions of a massive federal bureaucracy. Now, in the case of the dress, it's silly. And I literally still do not understand what the controversy is there. But look, if people can have a sort of reasonably cordial fight over something that ridiculous, maybe it's a good way to exercise some of our, I don't know, some of our base impulses and just get it out of our system. But on much more serious issues, and there are more serious issues we're about to get into, the notion that somehow the government should have a greater say in how we say things, in what we say, and how often we say it is really terrifying. And that this snuck up on us, now I've been talking about it for weeks, but that this wasn't more of a cause and that this wasn't getting more attention in the last couple of months is very problematic and I think suspicious. Not just suspicious from the perspective of the administration. They, of course, wanted this to sort of fly low and slow under the radar. They didn't want this thing to receive a lot of public debate. They didn't want the American people to sit around and think, what does it mean to give the government free rein over regulation of the internet, which is exactly what has happened? This is a massive and unprecedented digital power grab. Now, we've, as a country, become much more in tune with the way that the government has been collecting information and data, and we now understand that we already live in a state that goes beyond Orwell's wildest dreams in terms of what the government can access. Now, that's not to say that there's somebody sitting around like the Stasi in the Lives of Others, literally actively listening in on your phone calls, although they very easily could, and they do sometimes. In the case of the Stasi, it was a widespread program, but it relied on government informants and technology that, of course, was many decades behind where we are now. You needed someone to actually be actively listening and recording. They couldn't sift through it via, they couldn't sift through these terabits of data using, different algorithms. Now, though, we add to that, we add to the 1984 on steroids state that we have a government that can also actively now regulate all aspects of the web. And that's not to say that they have. I'm not trying to just tell you and focus on what happens now. I want to focus to some degree on what's going to happen because of what's happening now. We do this together day in and day out, talking about the Middle East, talking about the future of the Islamic State and the war on terror, which I still like that term. And I like the GWAT as well, which is what we used to call it, the global war on terror. That's how the cool kids used to say it. You can't stop when the GWAT is hot. That's what we used to say in the office. And the GWAT was hot, my friends, and it still is. But now we see that the government has decided that they should have, forget about what they have done today without looking at what they will be doing in the future. You can't do that. What they do today gives them a wide open field to do all sorts of things. And where the FCC goes, and this is, I used to be really good with the acronyms, but my acronym linguistics have eroded over time. In the agency, I used to be able to have whole conversations just with letters, just different acronyms and letters. And some of you in the military or who are former military will know what I'm talking about as well. I could look at, it was practically hieroglyphic sometimes, the PowerPoint presentations I would see from the intel community and from the military. I mean, it literally became almost a game to see how much data you could jam onto one slide that was really just jumbles of different letters and classifications and everything. And it was sort of like you had to be initiated to be able to read this stuff. And wow, they slammed a lot of data on those slides. They slammed a lot of stuff. I felt like an archaeologist who was trying to discover some or rediscover some long forgotten ancient dialect. But so the FCC goes after the internet now. And guess what? the FEC can't be far behind, the Federal Election Commission. They've wanted to do this sort of thing for a long time, and that they were quiet about it, that they were quiet about it, shows you exactly what the intent is. That they wouldn't share the 300 pages plus of regulation before they enacted them by federal fiat tells you everything you need to know about the intent here. Don't just get bogged down in what they have done. Look at what they're going to do. Why wouldn't they allow Congress to pass legislation that would have laid out very clearly what the protections would be for net neutrality on the web? Why leave it to regulatory fiat? Back to this notion of lies and lawlessness. They lied to you. They lied to all of us about net neutrality. They created a false conception of what net neutrality would actually be, because that was necessary in order to get this whole thing done. They made net neutrality sound like this wonderful concept of the internet as it is and always will be in perpetuity. That's what they promised. When people hear net neutrality, that's what they think of. When for a moment there was this merger of those on the left and on the right saying, yeah, yeah, net neutrality. We want the web to be, and really all that is a fancy way of saying we want the net to be the way it has been. And they said, well, if you want that, we're going to need the power to stop those big bad people, the internet service providers, from discriminating between different kinds of digital traffic over fiber optic lines. And then we'll be able to handle things for you. But what really happened, and of course, many of you, I'm sure, are having an Obamacare tingle, which sounds pretty terrible, but you know what I mean. Remember how they sold that to us? Well, rates are going up, and American healthcare is great, but rates are going up, and they could skyrocket soon, and we could see real problems. So we have an idea. Let's take it to the insurance companies. Let's show them who's boss. We're going to protect you from those big, bad insurance companies. And as we know, behind closed doors, they were saying, insurance companies, don't worry about it. We need you guys to be complicit in this thing because we're trying to fool the American people. It's going to be a huge giveaway for you. You're going to have people locked in. They're going to have to pay you for crap insurance. And you're not even going to have to really pay for any care for them. They're going to have really high deductibles, but they're too dumb to notice. That was the deal that Obama and his senior advisors and cronies cut behind closed doors with the insurance companies. They made them a deal that they literally could not refuse, but in the end, they probably didn't really want to refuse it. Because big business and big government go together like, I don't know, chocolate and raspberries or something. Whatever goes together well. So they lied to you about what net neutrality was, and then they were trying to lay low on it and just get this thing through. That it would happen on a party line vote, 3-2. And people say, oh, this is another fiction, by the way. Another lie, really. At least a pleasant fiction that the American people are supposed to believe and should not. The idea that this massive regulatory body of the FCC is somehow nonpartisan and nonpolitical, this is a joke. I mean, we know for a fact that the Supreme Court is partisan and political. And the federal judiciary, which, by the way, is one of the places where the Obama administration has made its deepest inroads and may have the longest lasting progressive effect of anything, including Obamacare, is stacking the federal bench. And how did he do that? Oh, that's right. Eliminating the filibuster for judicial nominees. That's been happening behind the scenes as well. Watch what the other hand is doing, my friends. So here we are now. We recognize that a 3-2, just like a 5-4 vote in the Supreme Court, and depending on which way that goes, the media goes, well, I mean, is it really legitimate because it was 5-4? Is a 3-2 FCC takeover of the internet something we're supposed to stand behind? And do you really think the FEC, which at one point was telling Americans, until Citizens United, hey, you can't make a movie about something and release it too close to an election. How is that not prior restraint? How is that not an abject and obvious threat to the First Amendment, violation of the First Amendment, in spirit and in letter? But still, people say, oh, foreign money, Citizens United, they just lie. They lie. Just always remember Justice Alito sitting in the front row of that State of the Union address, shaking his head, just like, this guy's just, what he was saying, without saying it because he was trying to at least respect the decorum of the event. But in his mind, what he's saying is, this guy's lying. This guy's lying. Lies and lawlessness. I am just beginning to get fired up here.
888-900-3393.
You're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
The Buck Sexton Show,
888-900-3393. We'll take a call now. We have Jill in Philadelphia on the line. Jill, you are on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck. I just wanted to let you know that their FCC is already starting in again on the fairness doctrine.
Oh, gosh.
Yesterday they published in the Federal Register, which I don't think that date of filing is a coincidence, new rules, quote, promoting diversification of ownership in the broadcasting services. So basically what they're doing is they're saying, well, we can't tell you what to say, but we're going to tell you who can own your broadcasting station, that you be diverse in ownership. And
wow.
They're going to collect data and do all this. And basically, I can't imagine them doing to newspaper owners what they want to do to broadcasters.
Yeah, I can imagine that's exactly what they're planning on doing. I mean, they've been talking about this for some time now, and the institution of a fairness doctrine on the web is really so much more powerful because, as I said, everything is coming together now. Everything is essentially, everything we see, rather, is going to be on the sort of digital spectrum, right? There's not going to be much. I know there'll be some print and such, but the real power, because, look, radio is going wholly digital. It's just a question of when. Television is already really digital. It's just there are some barriers, and cable companies have certain things that they're involved in. But this is, as I see it now, the single most important place that they could exercise real control.
Well, it's I can't imagine them doing it to newspaper owners, you know, like telling you who's allowed to own a station or who's allowed to own a newspaper.
Well, they've already been all that stuff is very highly regulated. All that stuff is very much already something that people can be told one way or the other they can do. I mean, radio stations. I mean, look, the FEC has its hands in our politics and in our culture and just in our communications in such strong ways. It's really hard for people to even really fathom, because we've just become used to it. We've become conditioned. And that sort of conditioning, I think, is something that we need to start to push back against and understand what the problems are here.
Well, I think, you know, I just wanted to bring to people's attention, you know, the comment period is now open on that new regulation. And, you know, they want to take comprehensive data on, it says, race, gender, and ethnicity of the owners and other interest holders in broadcast stations. So, you know, if you want the government to collect all this data, you know, then don't comment. But if you're a little afraid that they're going to start collecting this data, you may want to write something to the FCC on this.
Right. No, look, I can see that this is only going to get worse. Everyone I trust on this issue is saying that this is a disaster. So what else? You know, I've looked into it. Everyone I believe who knows what they're talking about realizes it's a disaster. So this is something we're just going to have to see. I wonder if we can unwind it. I think that there might be some. There might be problems with trying to unwind it, because you will create, again, it's like Obamacare. We want it to go away. But now people are realizing if it can't just go away all at once, actually, that would be a problem. You're going to have to find ways to sort of scale it down and eliminate it piece by piece. So we'll have to see. But thank you for calling in, Jill. We'll take some more calls after the break. 888-900-3393. Oh, the FCC, this is bad. Lies and lawlessness, my friends. Let's talk about some more lies and lawlessness in just a minute with a pending ban on a certain type of ammunition for the AR-15 and what that's all about. Because let me tell you, they've got plans. They're planning to do all kinds of stuff. All right. As I said, the Broad Voice is open. Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. You can also send me messages there on Twitter @Buck Sexton and Team Buck. We will be back in just a couple of minutes talking about ammunition. The ammo ban that could be has not been instituted yet. Other stuff we've got coming down coming down the lane in this show includes debate over a headscarf, D.C. legalizing pot, and the IRS. So much coming your way. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Sexton Show. Speak your mind. 888-900-3393.
All right, Team Buck, we know the Obama administration has been very clear about its desire to find end runs on the Second Amendment. It is, you can't even turn on pop culture. You can't even watch a, you can't even watch TV without, there'll be some injection, even on watching a show like, say, I don't know, Scandal. Or if you watch, if you used to watch The West Wing, there's always fierce moments of debate about a handgun bill or gun control. Gun control is something that gets the left really, really excited. And so that's something that I think we need to just always keep in mind. Because as much as we think, you know, they keep losing this battle, it doesn't matter. They don't care. And they're trying to play a very long game here. Just as I said, you have to watch what the other hand is doing and don't let them dominate our discussions and the narrative of what's going on in the present day. Understand that while they've also, while they've had this FCC intrusion, and now really it's an invasion of the web, and it's just, they've just, this is the beachhead, but from the beachhead can come the overall conquest. That's what this regulatory scheme does for them. But now they've done something, or are considering. I don't want to get ahead of my, I don't want to be in front of my skis here. I've actually never been skiing, but I like the phrase. I don't want to get ahead of myself. But there is an effort underway right now that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and I have to say that, that they've now, it used to just be ATF, and now it's BATFA. And I think that this is kind of a rebranding effort more than anything else, because the ATF had some, had some rough years in the 90s. And I also think that the notion of an ATF is in and of itself problematic. And we have how many law enforcement agencies do we have in this country? Federal, state, local. Start thinking about how many when you add them all together. We need a special federal agency to look for tobacco? Really? For firearms? Really? The FBI doesn't handle that? They don't handle explosives either? And I think this is, the moment you create an agency like this, of course, they need to justify themselves. And agencies also always want to grow. They need more resources. If you want more resources, you need more arrests. If you want more arrests, you have to find people to arrest. This is not good. But BATFA, Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, I don't think anyone actually calls it BATFA, but maybe we should start, has decided that they're, is considering a decision that would ban 5.56 M855 ammo. Now, this is generally referred to as light green tips, and they've been exempt for a long time now, as have other types of high caliber ammunition, from some regulations that deal with the piercing of the possibility this ammunition could pierce the armor worn by police. Police tend to wear, I mean, in this country, police wear soft body armor, which is not effective against high-speed, high-velocity projectiles, really. Not particularly effective. If you want to stop something like a 5.56 round or a 7.62, you need plate armor, which is very heavy. I've worn it. It's cumbersome, and but that's what you need. You need plate armor. You actually need ceramic plates, which are very heavy. And you see this. This is what, obviously, the military has in the war zones. But for the police, it's generally just reliant on the Kevlar knit, which essentially catches the bullet and prevents it from penetrating. It doesn't give a tremendous amount of blunt force protection. And that's why even if someone is shot with a vest on, they can suffer some pretty serious trauma. True of the plates, too, by the way. And also the bullet can get in between the plates. But nonetheless, if you have plate armor on, you have a much higher likelihood of survivability from a direct hit. And if you're hit with plate armor on by a lower caliber bullet, I mean, if you get hit by, with plate armor on by like a .22, you're going to be okay. If it hits the plate. But so usually, or up until now, 556M855MO has been considered fine. It's a very common, I believe, and I might be incorrect here, so you can scream at me on Twitter if I'm incorrect, or Facebook, facebook.com/BuckSexton. I believe that this is the most common in current usage ammunition for the AR-15 that that civilians are buying. So what are they thinking about doing? They're thinking about banning this kind of ammo. And this is just, again, by regulatory federal fiat. This is just, you know, putting that out there. This is just banning ammunition by bureaucratic decision. And this is where I see this going. See, again, you can get silenced on this issue if you allow it to become a discussion and debate only about what's happening today, right? If it's a debate about only what's happening right now, it's, well, how bad is it really? You know, there's other forms of ammo. There's other types of ammo you can use for an AR-15. So is this really that big of a deal? Now, some of you are already screaming, yes, it's a big deal. Well, let me tell you why I think this is a big deal. Because the way this works, and they've tried this time and time again, is if they can't eliminate something with one fell swoop with legislation, for example, then they can engage in really a death by a thousand cuts strategy, an incrementalist ban. So what you do is you ban the sale of a specific type of ammo, right? Because come on, how big a deal can that be? It's just one type of ammo. And then once that settles in and people sort of forget and they've transitioned over to something else, then you ban possession of specific. This is if you're a gun grabber. This is if you do not believe in the Second Amendment. This is if you're a progressive statist. This is the playbook. This is the template. Then you ban possession of specific ammo, except in some cases. Then you ban possession of specific ammo in all cases. Then why not throw in there a ban on magazine size or a certain type of magazine? And then you work on banning the possession of that magazine, never mind the sale of that magazine. And once you've essentially taken away the ability of the public to get the ammo for the weapon and also get the magazine necessary to load the ammunition into the weapon, then you work on banning the rifle itself. Now, let me explain how I think this works or how this process goes along. You see, it's not as simple as just this happens and the government does this and there's a vacuum. No, there are other factors that tie into this. And this is why an incrementalist strategy can be so effective. And it's why it's one that you have to be on guard against. Because the moment that you ban a specific type of ammo, for example, that ammo is going to not be manufactured in the same quantity for civilian use, right? That's just not going to happen anymore. It means the price of ammo will go up. It also means that there will be people who are less likely, perhaps. And remember, I'm thinking long, this is long term. This is a means of progressives eliminating the AR in 10 or 15 or even 20 years. But it all starts with these kinds of small bans. Small bans lead to bigger bans. So what they do is they make it so that it's less appealing to own an AR because the ammo is more expensive. Well, then less of them are manufactured. And then when less of them are manufactured, there's less civilian ownership of them. When there's less civilian ownership of them, then fewer people are willing to make a political stand in defense of their right to have this because they don't have it. Fewer people become angry when an outright ban looms. And so there's less political backlash to be concerned about. And then you could eventually institute the ban. But it creates the groundwork. You want fewer people to have these. If you're a progressive statist and you're trying to ban a certain firearm, a great way to do it is to make sure that it is as onerous and difficult. This is another version of how you eliminate guns in New York City. Legal guns, by the way, of course, not criminally owned guns. Those are going to be around forever. But what you do is you don't say it's a ban, or this is how they do it in D.C., or this is how they do it in Chicago. It's never a ban, right? Well, sometimes it's a ban, but usually it's a regulation. It's a modification. It's a stipulation. It's some sort of weasel word way of, well, we're going to make this a little more uncomfortable. Just turning the heat up slowly. Just move the dial a little bit. And so what they say is, fine, you can have a gun in New York. Fine, you can have a gun in Washington, D.C., but it's going to take a few days out of your life. It's going to require a good chunk of change. In New York, at one point, it was, I believe, $500 to try to get just a premise permit Just a premise permit, by the way, okay? This just means you can have it in your home and in a lockbox with separate ammunition in a lockbox. I mean, this isn't... But see, it's not a ban, man. You just have to have it stored in different places, and we have to put it in sort of a cryogenic freezer, and we have to have a thumbprint scanner on it, and we... This is what they're always trying to do because they just don't want you to have it. And if they make it unpleasant enough, they know that you won't have it. And that's what they're trying to do with the AR. This has no effect whatsoever on law enforcement safety. The moment you take into account who the other side actually is on this and what they believe that civilian ownership of firearms is bad and evil and that the government should never have to worry about the citizens having too many firearms. That's what they believe. They're trying to achieve that. That's all this is. There is no, this is not a threat to law enforcement. You know what a threat to law enforcement is? A tiny and very easy to conceal .22 caliber handgun up close and personal. That's more of a threat to law enforcement than green tip 5.56 ammunition. And law enforcement knows that. And the ATF knows that. But President Obama is putting pressure because, you know, he does have a pen and a phone and he could pick up that phone and he can call the head of the ATF or BATFA. He can call the head of whatever federal agency he wants and say, I want some action on this. He can affect the regulatory process with the ban of ammunition, just as he did with the FCC. Do you really think that these federal agencies are making big moves without the White House's say-so? Do you think that the people that have these jobs that serve, remember this, they serve at the pleasure of the president. The heads of these agencies are not civil servants, they are political appointees. You don't think that the White House is putting pressure on them? A ban today becomes a ban much bigger in the future. More coming up.
Right back.
The Blaze Radio Network. What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at theblaze.com.
We have Justin. Is he in Louisiana? My call screen just went down. This is a constant issue in the Freedom Hunt here. Do we have Justin in Louisiana?
I'm here.
Yes, sir. Thank you. You're on the Buck Sexton Show. What's up?
Hey, Buck. I'm a first-time caller. Actually, you're the first radio show I've ever called.
All right.
Just, I guess with the ammo thing that Obama is, you know, trying to push, it's, I guess when he was first elected president, you know, I wanted to give him the benefit of the doubt, but it just seems, especially since the last election, he's just really showing his true colors now, and unfortunately we don't have a Congress that's going to, you know, say or do anything to him of, you know, of worth. So, unfortunately, I almost feel like this is just the first step in, of many steps he's going to take, whether it's, you know, banning certain types of ammo or whatever other parts of the economy he's going to try to, try to corner. It just seems like he's just going to do whatever he wants to do at this point.
No, look, I think that what's been amazing is that the president, as much as, he's had two really just completely brutal elections in the midterms, at least for his party, even though now you have Republicans in full control of Congress, the president still is pushing an agenda, and it's one that is meaningful from a progressive point of view. He's still going after guns. He's still going after the environment. He's still dictating amnesty for immigration. He's now allowed the FCC to direct. And remember this, that we don't want this. This is the problem. It's not that we want control instead of them. We don't want the government to control this, period. So once they create government control, they're happy because as long as that exists, it is ideologically in line with them. Whereas for us, for conservatives, it's like, no, I don't want anyone in charge of the I don't want anyone in the government in charge of this. I don't want them to have that power in the first place. And it's very difficult to wrest power away from the government. You see this even with Republicans. You know, I keep saying any Republican who doesn't want to essentially make the tax code one page and have the rates be just rates. And, you know, they're just too excited to give out little favors to their donors and to have that authority, to have that political juice that they can pass out. So that's what I think we see. Do you have one other thought? I think I saw something here about World War One.
Yeah, I know how you do your book briefs or you do your deep dives every once in a while. And I was thinking maybe you could at some point do something about the Ottoman Empire, World War One, especially with the Armenian genocide. I think think if you did something like that, people would realize Turkey might not be exactly the friend that we think they are, and especially genocide of Christians in the Middle East isn't, you know, a new thing.
Well, that the Armenian genocide, which is a genocide of Christians, is still stonewalled by the Ottoman, and they get very angry when people bring this up. When the Turks, even today, to bring up the Armenian genocide, I mean, could you imagine that there's this refusal to accept reality? And this was not distant reality, by the way. This was in the time of the First World War. So it's really astonishing that they somehow are able to create this perception in America that they're very secular, very pro-Western, that exists, and there are some great Turks, and I have friends who are Turks, and all the rest. I have friends who are Turks. And whenever people say that, everyone starts rolling their eyes. It's true, though. But as a country and as a nation state, it is much more problematic than I think a lot of us are willing to realize. Thank you for calling. Oh, wait, sir, you're a first-time caller. You want a T-shirt? We can give you a T-shirt.
Sure.
Justin? All right. Well, if you'd like one, stay on the line. We'll send you a T-shirt. We have Jonathan up next. Jonathan, we got about a minute, but I want to bring you in before the next hour. What's up, buddy?
Hey, Buck. How are you doing?
Good. We only got 60 seconds, so lay it down.
All right. I got a guy who's on my Facebook page who's asking me, why is it so important to call it radical Islam? And he's saying that there's no reason that we should be calling it radical Islam because it's just labeling a part of a community. And saying that it does damage to the community rather than help isolate ISIS.
You know, I want to answer this question, Jonathan, but I only have 30 seconds, and so that'll be a... Let me say, Jonathan, I will start in the next hour with an answer to why should we call it radical Islam? Let's just go back to square one on this for a second. I'll do that in the second hour, Jonathan. Thank you very much for calling in. 888-900-3393, Team Buck. Much more coming your way. We're going to talk a bit about the IRS. Oh, yeah, that's going to be fun. And maybe a bit about a headscarf at Abercrombie. Huh? The dress is blue and black.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network. Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, so Jonathan from Texas asked a question right before. I think it's one we can spend a minute or two on, and then they'll move to the IRS. Why should we call radical Islam radical Islam? Beyond just the obvious sort of straightforward semantics of it and the idea that you should call something what it is, right? Because this is the counter argument to this, and you hear this on TV and from people in media, is, well, if in fact you continue to say this, what it really does is it offends people. And so you lose some of your would-be allies because you are creating offense by always saying radical Islam. But the problem with that logic, of course, and there's a lot of it, the problem that comes up right from the get-go is that the moment that you concede to the other side that you can't speak the truth, you're making not just a concession, but also a submission. You are giving up your right to speak in a way that is honest, and that's going to lead to all sorts of problems. But from a more sort of strategic and messaging standpoint, if you're not willing to speak of radical Islam as Islamic in some capacity, What possible way could the moderates inside of the faith, or really reformers are more important than moderates in this context. Why do the reformers think that they have the right, or rather they have the support even, to speak out and to try and disregard certain, this is what is required, and this is where this gets very tricky. That there has to be a disregarding of certain teachings that are without question in the canon of Islam, that are Islamic scripture, that are accepted as part of Islam. There would have to be certain teachings that are abrogated. And now there is, inside of Islamic theology, some background for this. some pretext, at least, for this, where later revelations, for example, in the Quran, abrogate earlier ones. And if there's any judgment that has to be made in Sharia jurisprudence, for example, a later revelation by Muhammad is considered to be of more value. Now, how you can square all of this with it's all the divine word of God as recited to a merchant in the Arabian Peninsula in the 7th century by the angel Gabriel, who took him on a mystical and magical journey to Jerusalem. I mean, how that all, that's someone else's discussion. That someone else can try to explain that one. But I'm just saying, for the purposes of how the theology applies today, there has to be a movement that has support and that feels not just supported with words, but morally supported. That there's a recognition that this has to change. If you won't call it what it is, you never deal with the root problem. There are teachings in the Islamic faith, not all of them, and this is what ends up happening. Someone will go on TV, and our friend Bob, oh yes, let me explain to you now the truth of Islam. And, you know, some guy, fancy British accent, goes on TV, and one of their favorite things, and this is, at least superficially, very effective, is to say, well, let's just be upfront about the fact that there are some things in Islam that are, in fact, very peaceful. That there are some things in, you know, some things in Islam that sound very Judeo-Christian in their sense of, you know, love and kindness or whatever. Some things. They'll pick them out and they'll say, well, what about that? And you'll say, well, I guess. And then usually someone on TV has to concede the point. And it's difficult to come back with, but what about teachings on martyrdom? What about teachings on one day the end will come and even a stone will say, there's a Jew behind me, come and kill him, which is a teaching in the Quran. Well, what about all that? At that point, you've already, the audience is already clapping for the individual who says, well, but what about these bits of peace and love that come out in the Quran? You see what I'm saying? If there's not a willingness to direct the attention to the parts that are seized upon, specific issues of doctrine, for example, on apostasy. I'm not just forget about ISIS for a second. This is mainstream stuff. And unless there is a rejection of this, then we'll just keep dealing with this problem forever. I know some of you think that we will be dealing with this problem forever. And historically speaking, you have a pretty strong case. We've only had interludes when it comes to this religious conflict. We have not actually had a cessation of hostilities. And that's going for 1,400 years now. Going on 1,400 years. So that's why it's important to call it what it is. Because that's actually the only way that you can ever get to a place where we don't have to continue to deal with this. And I don't know if we can get there, but if you won't call it what it is, if you'll say that this is just has nothing to do with anything, one, you're lying, two, you're acting like a coward, and three, you'll never deal with the problem. And it's our problem, too, as I've said before. It's my problem. Every time I get on a subway, every time I go to an airport, I have to think about radical Islam. It is a reminder of how it has inflicted itself upon our world in our day-to-day activities. Never mind the massive costs it has put on our economy, the costs it has put on our young men and women in uniform, on their lives. So it's our fight, too. And we certainly should be saying, there's a problem. This needs to be dealt with. Maybe we're not the ones to deal with it, but someone needs to say that there's a problem that needs to be dealt with and point to what the problem is. Because part of what's happened for a while now is this refusal, this constant apologetics, really apologias, defenses of how Islam has no problem. There is a problem. It's just like you're going through, just like anything else in life. The first step towards recovery is identifying that there is a problem and what the problem is. And that's why we have to say what it is. All right, let's take a call from John in California. John, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Shields high, sir.
Shields high, sir. What's up?
I just wanted to say, if you want to see a place where incrementalism has destroyed the Second Amendment, all you have to do is look at California. We are now limited to a 10-round magazine. There are certain guns we can't use. We have a roster of guns that are legal, and most of them are you know, 10 or 15-year-old guns. There are more and more guns that are removed from the roster each month. And this government in California will continue to do that. And if you don't think the federal government is working toward that, you're a fool. Well, there is such,
right.
There's such a movement. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I just wanted to add to what you're saying with that. They're not, I mean, the progressives are not so stupid as to think that banning one type of gun is going to do anything, but they are smart enough, they are devious enough to figure out that once you've established the premise for banning one type of firearm, that can be applied to all the others. Once you have established that 5.56 ammo is armor piercing and therefore a threat to cops, you can ban all 5.56 ammo. That's how they see it. So we need to see it in those same terms.
Exactly. And the old standard of if you're carrying a firearm, be forewarned that someone with a knife can actually get to you faster than you can get your gun out and shoot them. It applies to police officers too. So I don't see any mass attempts to ban knives, but yet they seem to be more lethal in the aspect of being able to get them out and use them than a firearm.
I would have to look at the statistics, but I'm willing to bet that more people are killed in this country every year. I mean, this is off the top of my head. So somebody, Scott, take a look and see if I'm right on this. But more people are killed every year with knives than by AR-15s in this country. I would assume that's true. I'd be shocked if that was not true. I assume it's a wide margin.
I would bet more people are killed with hammers than AR-15s in this country.
I think you're probably right.
There's such a disgust with the government here in California. There's a
100% true. We just had a check. Just so you know, there's absolutely true that more people are killed with knives than killed by ARs in this country every year. No question. So yeah. But by the way, there are efforts sometimes to ban knives. New York's knife regulations are such that, as I understand it, any knife that can be opened with gravity can essentially be treated as a concealed weapon, and you're up to the discretion of the officer who sees you, and, you know, it's ridiculous. You're supposed to show it, and they have all these regulations. They just don't want people carrying knives at all, period. So there are knife bans, too, by the way. That's not – edged weapons are by no means free of this kind of, you know, bureaucratic intrusion. But, my man, John, I gotta bounce here into a break. Wait, have you ever called in before? Is this your first time?
This is my first time to call in, sir.
All right. Well, if you would like, we will send you, because you're a first-time caller, we'll send you a T-shirt, John. Freedom Hut, Commie Bear, Team Buck, whatever you want, all right?
That would be wonderful. Thank you.
All right, sir. Stay on the line. Thank you very much for your excellent call. The team, the Broad Voice, is open, 888-900-3393. Let's talk IRS when we come back. This is going to be fun. Be right back.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level. Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network. This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The IRS. I maybe should have led with this one, actually, today. There's so much, though. As I said, there's so much going on. And it's almost hard to get it all going because we're all focused on the llamas and the dress that is obviously blue and black. Obviously. You can change the tint and the color all you want, my friends. The dress is blue and black. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go on Twitter or just Google "the dress is blue" and you'll see what I'm doing. Well, actually, no, don't Google that. Sorry. Google Twitter "dress blue and black" and then you'll be able to see what I'm talking about. Apologies for that. So you'll see what I mean. It's this big meme. It's like taking over the internet. The internet is broken now because of, well, not just because of the FCC, but because people are fighting over the color of some dress. I don't even know how this started. This is one of the most bizarre memes ever. The IRS, however, is really hoping that you don't pay attention to this. And this is on the Blaze .com today. Jason Howard, my man Jason Howard, and with the piece here. More Lois Lerner emails recovered. No one will ever believe that both your hard drive and mine crashed within a week, she wrote. Think about that for a second. Let me just give you some of the details here. The House Oversight and Government Reform Committee announced on Thursday night that hundreds of former IRS official Lois Lerner's previously lost backup tapes have been recovered, which could result in the recovery of a new trove of her emails. IRS Deputy Inspector General Timothy P. I don't know if it's Camus, like the French philosopher, or if it's Camus, or Camus, C-A-M-U-S, but whatever. He told Representative Jason Chaffetz on Thursday that it took investigators only 2 weeks to recover 424 backup tapes, and this is the key part, that were previously said to be irretrievable. To date, quote, to date, we have found 32,744 unique emails that were backed up from Lois Lerner's email box. We are in the process of comparing these emails with the IRS has already produced to Congress to determine if we did, in fact, recover any new emails. In one of the emails, Lerner apparently wrote, quote, no one will ever believe that both your hard drive and mine crashed within a week of each other. Yeah, Lois, you're right on that one. Nobody believes that. This is astonishing. They're now treating this, by the way, they're investigating this for, quote, potential criminal activity. And this is just beginning to unfold here. When Chaffetz asked Camus, if anyone from the IRS had ever been asked for the backup tapes before, he replied no. Quote, we send a subpoena. This is Chaffetz speaking. We send a subpoena. We send letters. We have hearings. We hear all kinds of excuses from the IRS. Every excuse you can have under the sun. And you find them in 2 weeks. And then when you go to talk to the IT people who are in charge of them, they told you they were never even asked for them. Is that correct? That is correct, Camus replied. Can I just let all that sink in for a second? Let's all sit here together in the trust tree, in the nest, and let's let this just, we'll soak this up for a second. The IRS said they could not retrieve these emails. Everybody who knows anything about the internet, even people who, like me, are pretty limited when it comes to their internet abilities. Anyone who knows anything knows that that was a lie. But they said, they stuck to it anyway. They said, oh no, we can't get those emails. We can't get those emails. And now not only do they find emails that, of course, we knew were retrievable and were told that they were not, it's coming out that the people who could have gotten these emails were never even asked to get them. Now, you can believe, if you want, that the most intrusive, most arbitrary, and most destructive agency of the federal government is just so inept on this one specific issue. Remember, for you, got to have years of receipts packed up in a drawer somewhere in case they want to give you a really good once over. But for them, on an issue that would undermine the integrity of the entire organization, if it even has any integrity, I just believe they are essentially enforcers of a corrupt system. That's what I believe. Nonetheless, if you believe all of that, I don't know what to tell you. Because what we've seen here is that the chances of anything other than an obvious and blatant cover-up of communications between a senior IRS official, remember, the IRS official in charge of the program that went after Tea Partiers. She was the point person, number one for that. It doesn't matter that she's not the IRS commissioner. This was her purview. This was in her bailiwick. That magically, after she admits wrongdoing, after she knows she can hear the barking dogs in the background coming on the trail, she knows that they're coming after her. She admits wrongdoing. She pleads the fifth, okay? She pleads the fifth. And then nothing. Just goes on with everything, like everything's fine, no charges filed. They can't find anything. An agency of the federal government that expects all of us to have everything in hard copy, in original, never mind just the electronic information they have access to. They say that they lost all these emails. They say, as Lois Lerner apparently says, according to the Washington Times here, they say no one will ever believe that both your hard drive and mine crashed within a week of each other. Yeah, that's right. No one will ever believe that. there's not just smoke, my friends. There's fire. We're just not allowed to see it yet. What does this mean? And I'm glad that there are some who have stayed on the trail here, and I think that you have to, as much as we criticize many of our representatives in Congress, I think you have to applaud Congressman Chaffetz here and others for staying on this. Of all of the scandals of this administration, I know no one lost their life in this targeting. It's a, some of you would say, Benghazi. But Benghazi was incompetence, followed by lies, followed by a refusal to accept the threat we face. We know all of that now. The IRS scandal, if it is what many of us think it is, was an effort from inside the federal government, from a powerful agency, in many ways the most powerful agency for your average American, an effort to suppress a very potent political narrative in a presidential election year. And you can never prove what would have been, but all you can say is in 2010, the Tea Party was essential. And in 2012, the Tea Party was suppressed. What becomes of a political movement that's never allowed to actually gather? What becomes of a political idea that is suppressed? You don't know. But they knew. There were some in the IRS who have admitted, they've admitted wrongdoing. This is what people say, this is a non-scandal. The IRS has already said, yeah, we did this. But it was just a few rogue employees, if you recall. Or, oh, it was just confusion. It was the fog of IRS warfare. Really? Just answer this one question for me, my friends. In the words of Lois Lerner, no one will ever believe that both your hard drive and mine crashed within a week. Would they? Well, do you? Do you believe that those two hard drives crashed in the same week? The answer to that question tells you everything you need to know. Back in a minute.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network. Sexton.
All right, team, the broad voice lines are open, 888-900-3393. Let's take Ken in Phoenix, Arizona. Ken, you're on the Buck Sexton Show. I hope it's nice and warm down there.
It's fantastic in Phoenix.
So what's going on, sir? What's on your mind? Shields high, sir.
First-time caller. Listen, I was just wondering, everything that's going on, it seems like it's all connected somehow. When you go back over this administration over the past 6 years, with the racial division, the Department of State leaks, the outing of the agency operatives, the IRS targeting, the distancing from our allies like Israel, so on and so forth, it seems like he has a policy of, you know, reducing the standing of the United States in the world. But why? With the taking or the regulations on the bullets and everything else, it seems like his foreign policy that he really doesn't care much about is almost a tactical diversion, kind of like the Saul Alinsky deal, the unjustified the means, you know. And if you can't crack you can't make an omelet without cracking a few eggs, then that's what you're going to have to do and put up with. And it's just to the point to where everyone is looking around at the latest headline of the day, but when you string them all together and you look back over time, they seem to fit rather well for domestic policy. You know what I mean?
Well, there's a lot to chew on there. Are you sort of just generally, other than just adding your comments into the show, I mean, are you posing to me, why does Obama do the things he do? Why does Obama do the things he does?
Well, it's more of a thing of why doesn't somebody sit down and analyze the steps that he's taking to get to the end goal that he's looking at getting to? I think that there's enough historical fact now, and looking back over time at where he came from, and now that we know who he is and what his ideology is and everything else, instead of waiting for the next thing to happen of what he's going to do through regulation or executive order or memo or whatever he's going to do, why isn't his agenda exposed to the American people?
I think it's been exposed now. Look, there's those of us. Thank you for calling in, Ken. Always good to have a first-time caller, and I hope it's nice there down in Phoenix. I have to say, I saw before some tweets from people down in Dallas. I think it's like 27 degrees down there today, and it is snowing. And welcome to our world, Dallas. You know, usually I go down there, I go down to the Mercury office in Dallas, and everyone's basically, it's, you know, it looks like they just got back from the beach. They're all tan and happy and got a lot of sun, and they could, you know, maybe put a little above ground pool outside the studio to take a dip in or something. Or, you know, everyone looks like it's just, they're just loving the 75 degrees and clear skies weather. Welcome to our world, Dallas. It snows down there too sometimes. Sorry, you got to deal with that. But on the issue of Obama, excuse the ridiculous weather diversion for a minute. On the issue of Obama, we know more about him now in a sense because he's been more open about what he actually wants for the country and what he believes. But now it's those of us who said that he was pretending to be different things to different people have been proven correct. And the administration admits this now. For example, I mean, the best example I can point to on this, other than all the contradictions, for example, his contradictions on the use of executive orders and his contradictions on the use of the FCC and the Internet and the way the regulatory scheme is gone. There are so many things you can point to where the president has gone back on what he said when he was trying to get elected, particularly the first time back in 2008, 2009. But what we see now is it's now that he doesn't have to face the electorate again. Things like, well, the president never really believed that he needed to defend traditional marriage. For example, they say this, and they say it almost with a degree of glee, and back to the initial premise of today's show on lies and lawlessness, that was a lie. They tell us now that it was a lie, but because it's politically attractive and because they don't think that they have to worry about exposing this anymore, now it's better to say, well, he was always for gay marriage. He was always on the side of gay marriage. Now that they believe that that's the country has shifted in that direction, right? But what's lost, of course, in the Axelrodian translation of this is that the president lied to us. He lied to all of us. He lied to the electorate in order to get elected. He basically thought that it would be useful for him to pretend to be for traditional marriage. It also bolsters the idea of the president as not just nominally or culturally Christian in some capacity, but a believer, which is what he has espoused to be, particularly and vociferously in the earlier years of his presidency. Right. So he was a believing Christian who believed in traditional marriage. That was Obama 2008-2009. Now we are told, I'm not even going to get into the whole religion thing again because we've already talked about that. Now we're told he never believed in traditional marriage at all. Well, so what you're saying, really, what Axelrod, his like chief consigliere, his chief advisor here, what Axelrod is saying is, yeah, he's a liar, but he knew that that was a good thing to lie about at the time, so he did. So when people now are pointing out that we're seeing the real Obama in a way we couldn't before, this is not a conspiracy or drawn from nothing. This is based upon the facts that are being presented to us now. This is based upon the stuff that we're being told. So why wouldn't we think that there's more here? Why wouldn't we believe that there'll be further revelations about what Obama really believes? And I always have to say this, too. Cast out this notion of, well, you know, if the president was such a socialist, he would have just nationalized industry in this country. You know, the sort of the pseudo-intellectual claptrap that you hear from people about how, well, you know, Obama's a centrist or whatever. You know, he's been a centrist. Obama has pushed as far as he conceivably could at every point in his presidency for the progressive wish list. And you can run down all of the different policy items and ideas, immigration, guns, health care, climate, you name it, at every point that he can, within the limits of maintaining power while he had to. It all makes sense. He had to say that in his own mind and in the minds of his advisors, he had to say he was for traditional marriage to get elected. He had to stay his hand on some of these executive orders to get reelected. Just as we see, why did he wait on amnesty until he had been reelected? Notice how, by the way, they didn't even do it in the first 2 years when he had open runway. Democrats had control of both houses of Congress, didn't do it then. And then certainly because he had to focus on, right, the takeover of health care. But then he had to worry about a reelection. And so some of these issues had to be put until after his election. But you're seeing that this is what he intended all along. So in a sense, now you see what's behind the curtain. Now you're getting to see what the president really believes. And some of us have known this, and many of you have known this the whole time. But now it's official, right? Now it's out there for everyone to see. And there's much less of a backlash against it from those who are reasonable. Of course, the media is always going to say that. And keep in mind, this is going to be Obama's beliefs, religious beliefs, his background, his race, everything is still a useful third rail that the media can try to push, metaphorically speaking, future presidential candidates towards. They want to taint people while they still can with being part of that. So there's still this. That's the only thing that keeps there from being a very open discussion, for example, of the fact that Obama, again, lies in lawlessness, lies about what he believes and what he wants to do and what will happen when he's given power, and then lawlessness when he has that power. Decisions to just do what he feels like doing as the president, as the executive branch, and cutting out the legislature in the process and tearing at the very fabric of the Constitution, the separation of powers. You know, you can look at Jonathan Turley down at George Washington University. He'll say somebody who voted for Obama. There are Democrats now are saying, look, this is just bad stuff. This is unprecedented stuff. This is FDR Woodrow Wilson style progressivism. And now you're seeing it because there's no reason for the president to hold back. It's all really rather Machiavellian. Let me just take Joe in Vermont before we go into break here. Joe, you are on the Buck Sexton Show.
Shields high, Buck.
Shields high, sir.
Well, now that my heart rate has gone down a little bit after your little chat about the IRS, I guess I can quote both of our favorite Secretary of State and say, at this point, what difference does it really make? Buck, do you think Lerner is going to go to jail for this?
I do not think she's going to go to jail.
Then we are lost. You know, you're talking about, you've spoken at length before about the slow roll and, you know, how they drew this out. Some other curious things about the 2012 election, there were whole precincts in which, you know, Mitt Romney didn't get a single vote, which statistically speaking, even if everyone there intended to vote for him, it's very unlikely that at least one person wouldn't have pulled the lever for the wrong person. So many things. I mean, it's been obvious for a long time that there's no lie that this administration won't tell. There's no depth to which they won't sink to accomplish their goals. And for people who think that, you know, the president is not a socialist and that, you know, our country has not been socialized, you know, what the federal government right now can tell you who to hire. They can tell you how much to pay them. They can tell you what you have to do in order to let them go. They tell you how you have to compensate them in terms of benefits. They control all payments for health care. You know, that's pretty much socializing a lot of businesses. And, you know, we're in a pretty critical state right now, and I think that people have to open their eyes, you know, and understand that we definitely have to scale back the federal government. It's you know, you can probably tell that I'm pretty enraged by what you have said about Lois Lerner. And, you know.
The only way I can see us ever really finding out what happened with the IRS would be if they gave Lois Lerner total immunity. But even if you gave her total immunity, the Democrat machinery would be sort of like the mafia thugs waiting in the background saying, are you really going to talk? Are you really going to talk? You know, it would be, I don't think even if you gave her immunity necessarily, you would get to the whole truth. But absent that, you have no chance at all. And maybe she will. We'll see. We'll see what's in these emails. But, you know, it's going to have to be absolutely definitive for them to press any kind of charges. And we'll see. It's amazing to me that it's taken this long to get this far, I guess. That's part of my frustration. But Joe from Vermont, Always good to hear from you, buddy. All right, Team Buck, we're into a break. We're going to finish up strong. Back in just a minute.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Get your Team Buck t-shirt at theblaze.com.
On this notion of lawlessness, by the way, I might have to spend more time on this on Monday. This is one of those things that I wanted to get to today. But the District of Columbia approved by nearly two-thirds in this past November Initiative 71, which allows people 21 or older to possess 2 ounces or less of marijuana, use marijuana on private property, or give 1 ounce or less to another person as long as no money, goods, or services are exchanged. So sort of trade and barter possession of marijuana up to certain levels, okay. And you can give it to people for free under this initiative in D.C. This is fascinating because this really brings home to us that the law is now just politics. The law really doesn't have any meaning anymore, because if you have a resolution passing the District of Columbia that explicitly violates federal law, what are we supposed to think about federal law? Now, what are you supposed to believe? Who do you believe? If you live in D.C. now, do you believe that Metro Police will leave you alone? Or do you believe the federal government that's saying, no, this is still illegal? Now, as you know, and I know many of you disagree, I believe in the legalization of marijuana for a whole host of reasons that I can't get into today. But I also don't believe in laws that exist at cross purposes. You have to rectify this. You can't have the federal government continue to say that's illegal under our laws and states saying, no, it's not. We've decided otherwise. This is going to be a huge. This is another form of lawlessness that's occurring under this administration. Even though I like the outcome in a sense, and I know many of you disagree, that's OK. But in this case, at least we've got to have clear laws. Real quick, Bart in South Carolina, what do you got?
I was going to talk about yoga pants, but all this.
You got about a minute, so that's probably enough time for yoga pants. What's on your mind?
Okay, yoga pants. Well, as you know, most young women in this country have turned to yoga pants, which in some ways is pretty good. As a dirty old man, you know, I find them pretty nice to look at. However,
this is getting weird. Go ahead.
Yeah. I don't think they're necessarily universally appropriate. You're starting to see them at funerals and in classrooms and fancy restaurants and so forth. But the issue I have with them, I think, is that they are erasing the natural boundary lines between classes of women. You can't just look at a woman these days and tell what kind of woman she is by her dress. Because
wow, Bart, I didn't think we were going. Bart, I got to cut you because we only got 20 seconds left, but I want to get you in before we close out for the week here. I don't even know what to say to that other than I'm pro yoga pants in a big way, so there's that. Plus, the dress is blue and black. There's that. Team Buck, I'm very excited to be joining you again Monday, obviously. Have a great weekend. Please share the podcast liberally with friends. Shields high.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.